Reasonable. It's the reasonable. It's the reasonable. It's the reasonable. Coming to you every day.
Welcome back to the Reset Rebel podcast with me, Jo Yule, and I do believe that today is number 193. Cannot believe that we're only 7 episodes away from 200, so very much gunning towards that goal at some point this year. But for today's show, we are sitting on the glorious sunny sands of Sant'Eulalia, overlooking the marina. It's an absolutely glorious April day, and I'm very excited to be introducing you to lighting director and intimacy and tantric coach, Mr. Buzz.
Hello, good morning. How are you doing?
I'm very good. Thank you so much for coming to join us here on this, very spectacular spring morning.
Yes, thank you. And congratulations for having so many episodes and great content.
Thank you very much indeed. Yeah, it's been a bit of a labour of love, really, over the last 6 years. We had our birthday last month, which I actually completely forgot about because we were actually on stage at TEDx, actually, together around about that time.
Yes, I was lighting you up.
You did, Buzz. I think that's what you do, isn't it? Light everybody up.
That's my intention, yeah.
I mean, what got you into lighting people up? How did this all begin for you?
Oh, I loved the magic of theatre. I really was enthralled with how beautiful and how magical and how otherworldly a dark theatre that lights up and stories are told within it. And I wasn't a very, very good storyteller. When I was on stage, I had a lot of stage fright and I was horrible at remembering my lines. But I really wanted to be involved. And because I was the tallest person in the room, then I would be the one that would have to move the lights around and the one to jump up on a ladder and get things going up there. And I really got turned on by that. I really enjoyed how just a single spotlight could set the mood on stage. And I really got into the sort of the subtleties of stage work.
Interesting. I hadn't really kind of thought about it from that perspective, but having experienced it directly with your wonderful work, yeah. I kind of like it. It is something quite special that happens when that spotlight is actually on you.
I really like it. I remember sitting with my daughter one time in an empty theater, and I was like, here, wait, check this out here. And I put a chair in the middle of the stage, and she was just looking, and I was like, yeah, great. And I was like, now watch this. I turned off all the lights. I just put this like little blue in the background, and then this little light, a little amber on it, and then like slowly brought it up. And she was 4, and she said, it's beautiful. And just to sort of like share in that magic of how setting a scene, you know, and lighting is a really easy and great way to be able to set a scene. Sort of the context of our story of life. I really like to play with the subtleties of that.
Is that something that you've studied, or is it just something that's kind of become intrinsic to your, you know, general daily doings?
It was a great interest, and then in university I didn't major in theatrical studies or technical theater, but I did do a lot of technical theater classes, so yes, I did study academically as well.
So where have you worked in Ibiza? I mean, we talked about working at Leo, being one of those phases of your Ibiza life.
Yeah, Leo. I was the lighting director for Leo when they opened, and I remained the lighting director for them for 5 years. And that was an amazing experience because I've done a lot of circus work before in Barcelona. And so Leo was this beautiful celebration of cabaret and circus performance, but also really high quality dance, which I love doing lighting for dance. Because often in lighting the theater, if nobody notices your lighting, that you're doing a good job. And then as well, nightclub lighting is a bit like, we call it flash and trash. whereas dance lighting, you actually get to be kind of a character on stage with how you frame the dancers. And so Leo was a beautiful challenge. It's also a challenge because it's outdoors. It's in a terrace. You have all kinds of white things that reflect your light all over the place. But it was a really, really good challenge. It was a really fun team and amazing quality performers to be able to step up that level every night. And they call it Leo for a reason, because it's just chaotic. Because they have so many shows and so many unplanned things happen with so many different people in the audience that it was an exciting challenge for 5 years. I also had a newborn daughter at that time. And after 5 years, it was just complete burnout. Like, there was just, it was really hard to keep up that rhythm. And so I kind of stayed away from lighting for a while. But now, in the last few years, I've been offered things that are much more my style. And the Garden of Light, for example, I've been the lighting director for 2 seasons now at the Garden of Light. And they really have an emphasis as well on the mood of the area and not just sort of selling bottles at the VIP area. And I really appreciate that. So they really put an emphasis on the music and the ambiance. And the lighting, of course, is a really big part of that ambiance. So I feel really appreciated there. And it's really, as well, fun to play and be a character within the event.
What spectacles can you tell us a story about that you observed at Leo? You say it was chaos and all sorts of, you know, unplanned events unfolded.
Yeah. Oh, there's lots of things. One of my favorite things is that when Anne Hathaway was in the audience. And we every night we have one where we pick a random person out of the audience. And there was much debate about how and if she should be picked. And she was. And she was super into it. And it was really, really cool. Of course, you can see like this epic actress on stage in her element, even when she's off the clock, just to see the amazing presence she had and how much she brought to the stage. And how it was really nice to see someone who I've seen on stage or on screen be so casual and yet also still really be within her element. That was really nice to see.
What does she do?
Well, it's a whole kind of long story, but there was a joke that was an every night joke, and it always had the same response of where the MC would say something about who's your partner, and almost always they would be with a partner, and they would point to somebody in the audience. And he would say, oh, he's ugly. And then it was just the joke. And everybody would laugh. And this person would feel awkward and laugh and be like... And then the joke was like, oh, but is he rich? Oh, and that was kind of like the thing, you know, and to play with that idea of the rich and the elite. And in Leo, like, that's kind of a fun thing to play with the audience. And the millisecond that he started with a joke of, oh, he's ugly, Anne Hathaway clocked him. She slapped him square across the face. And there was a picture the next day that our photographer showed everybody. And the picture is our MC with his lips all over to the side and his face all scrunched up. And Anne Hathaway, the most poised and beautiful and calm you could ever imagine, but with her hand raised up. And she was like, that's my man, I'll defend him. Just no hesitation whatsoever. Just that sort of like grounded poise and confidence is epic to see. And you can see how the professionals, how they do it.
Good Lord. Yeah, I didn't expect that.
No, right. Nobody did. Nobody did. It was amazing. the entire crew of Leo that we've seen everything were just dumbfounded and shocked and for me, like, giddy.
Was that the highlight of your time at Leo?
Oh, no. I've seen lots of other things that I'm not really supposed to be talking about. But no, I saw lots of things that I really
enjoyed. No one listens to this podcast. You can tell me.
Oh,
come on, Buzz.
I saw Arnold Schwarzenegger do the twist, which was pretty amazing.
And was he any good?
He was great. He was a really good sport, actually. Yeah. Will Smith, I saw him get jiggy with it.
How jiggy?
Leonardo. Oh, super happily jiggy. It was really interesting to see Hollywood stars having fun, and which kind of elite people you've heard of or, you know, how not have so much fun. That was really interesting. And Will Smith, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Leonardo DiCaprio are all people that really just had fun, and you could just see they're kind of like enjoying their lives and their fame and their wealth. And
Leo at Leo, I mean, that's got a good ring to it.
Yeah, he was a regular for the years that I was there, or at least the last few years that I was there.
I mean, he's spotted every single summer on this island. It's got his name written all over it, really. Ibiza, hasn't it?
It would also be an interesting chat. Sometimes it's a distraction, but usually not. Like, mostly you're in the show and you're really on your performance and what you're doing for the show. But at a couple of different nights, I had the general manager, while I'm in the middle of a 85Q show that I'm running the lights like really intensely and really focused, the general manager comes up and is like, Buzz, immediately you have to take the lights down on table 501 because Leonardo DiCaprio says it's too bright. So in the middle of this crazy show, of course, instantly I have to like switch gears and go over to the table lighting page and remember which table that is and bring that down. And yeah, sometimes that kind of things would happen. But that's Leo. That's what it was. And it was actually part of the appeal of the job as well, was that sort of crazy in the moment chaos.
But Leo didn't want to be lit up at Leo.
No, Leo likes to be like a little bit, you can understand.
Fading into the background.
He gets the spotlight a lot, so it's probably nice for him to watch a show for once.
Well, he's on holiday anyway. I mean, I guess he comes here to be a little bit incognito, but yeah. At the same time, it's kind of like almost an impossible task.
Yeah, hard to do. Yeah.
Anybody else?
No, that's kind of all I can think of for now, yeah.
So you say that you prefer your Garden of Light residency. Is that happening again this summer?
It is. Yeah, I'll be the director for Garden of Light again this year. Yeah, they already have a great lineup, which is secret actually. But I know the first couple of bands, and it's really, really nice. They really bring quality and beautiful people who are really creating their music and their voice and their vision and their heart and what they want to share. And that I find that kind of rare in the music industry. Well, I don't want to say in Ibiza too judgmentally, but I think a lot of modern music is music that has been written by quite a few different producers who, with the intention of creating the hit of the summer, and often successfully. But the sort of the days of where musicians are just like in their own emotions and translating that as an expression for the rest of us, I don't see so often. And every single artist who has performed over the last 2 years at the Garden of Light has fit that bill, and you just see them raw. And what is unique about the Garden of Light is that the artist is in the middle, so it's sort of theater in the round, which creates lighting challenges, but it really makes it an intimate setting, and it really feels like these artists are in your living room, kind of. And people treat it as such, and they often are laying down, there's pillows, and it's sort of this vibe where you actually get to listen to somebody's heart, and you can really feel it. There's space for you to really feel it. There's no distraction from trying to sell you bottles of booze. There's no alcohol being sold at the Garden of Light. So it's just this real focus of the music and the experience. And of course, people get up and dance and go crazy at some points as well when the artists are expressing that. But then usually as well, at the end of the concert, often we'll be laying down again. Or sometimes the artist will be like, okay, let's bring it down. Okay. And they'll be like, Buzz, can you turn off all the lights for a moment? And in darkness, we'll all look at the stars before the next song. Like, there's some magical moments there. And to be part of that as lighting and not just, not only a frame, but actually being really part of the experience. That's the kind of lighting that I really enjoy doing. That sort of delicate touch and sensitivity to the exact moment within what the artists are trying to express, and to sort of like frame that for them and let that be seen, because they're doing such an amazing job at being heard. It's kind of let that be seen as well, so that people can see the expression on their faces but without being distracted by it. I really like that sort of subtlety in the work of lighting, and you don't often get a chance to do that in theater. Again, like I said, you have to be kind of off stage, and although literally, but like sort of as an analogy as well, but to actually be part of the show in a way that really helps the expression of the main artist, I love that. And Garden of Light is that experience. I've had some performances that are like that as well that will pop up. I'll be doing lighting for a dance company in November, for example, and they as well saw my work at TED, and they were like, oh, I really like what you did, how you framed my dancers, and so I'd like you to continue to do that with us. That kind of thing I really enjoy. So
incredible. But how do you switch then from A to B to going to, into that kind of more subtle world?
From, you mean working at Leo or working at a nightclub or something? Well, I think refusing to do it anymore. When I'm offered often parties, events that are all night long. Ibiza house parties, famously, forever, are pretty raucous, crazy events, which require nice, fun lighting and DJ effects and lasers. And usually there's a lot of drugs in attendance and a lot of alcohol and a lot of people that I think if you just had a couple flashlights up, I think they would be like, wow, and be super impressed with the lighting. So it feels, although it can be lucrative, it's a bit soul sucking. And so I think just refusing to do that kind of things. And luckily I do have other means of income. So it's, I'm not a lighting designer because that's my career and that's what I need to do in order to pay the food on the table for my daughters, you know. Luckily, I'm a massage therapist and as you mentioned, an intimacy coach, and I run tantra retreats. So, like, I have a lot of different ways that I don't need to be doing events that I don't really want to do. So I think, but if you want to make that switch, if someone wants to make that switch, then to really just refuse to do the things that aren't nourishing you, and that will open up space for things that can nourish you. Especially if you start saying, like, no, I don't do that anymore. Then people start hearing that and they start thinking of you differently. Once you do one event where you do a party and everybody loves the lights, that's it. They're going to call you for parties for the rest of your life. But if you say no, and you say, well, no, because I'm doing this now, then people are like, oh, he does this now. And then people talk and people like to share their contacts. And so I know a guy who does, you know, hippie, that hippie music kind of vibe. Yeah, you should call him. Or whatever, you know, they want to categorize it, you know, but you'll start getting called for that.
But you have done a few crazy wild house parties.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, and I've sat there at 6 a.m. been like, what am I doing? And people love you and they love it and they come up and they kiss you and they're like, oh, your music is the best music I've ever heard. And you're 10 meters away from the DJ, which is very obvious with headphones, and he's rocking out and I've got lights on him. It's just exactly. Oh my God, that new song you put was so good. What was it?
Did you just style it out and pretend you were?
I have done, but usually I just say thank you. I'm like, oh, thank you. And then I go.
Try not to roll your eyes.
Yeah. The best I can.
That does sound like fun, though, and quite tempting just to sort of lap up that adoration.
No. Not if it's ill-placed, not if it's... I will try and say, like, actually, the DJ's over there. And they'll look very confused and then go over to bother the DJ. And then the DJ will often look at me with a kind of a scowl. Like, you could have taken that one for me if you wanted. Yeah.
Ah, well, it sounds very colourful, your road to doing the exact kind of lighting work that you want to be doing. I mean, you say... How did you even end up in Ibiza doing lighting anyway? I mean, you're obviously not from here.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I've had sort of a long road from growing up in rural Virginia. I was born in the very cool New York City, but my family moved when I was 2, so I kind of missed that whole funky, cool, hipster childhood that perhaps I could have had. And then I went off traveling with a lot of... being very, very timid about traveling, being quite fearful of traveling, actually, because in the States, most of the population doesn't have a passport even, and traveling isn't like a really huge part of our culture. You have to go really far to get to a different culture in the States, so there's not a lot of inspiration for that. But I made it out. Well, I made it cross country first, and then I went to England. You know, like, ooh, exotic England,
so exotic,
right? Yeah. I bet, you know, like for a little small town boy, like, wow, you know. and then slowly, like, you know, and then went through Europe, and slowly kind of started breaking out, and then Southeast Asia, and then of course India, and then really kind of discovering what travel is all about. But I ended up in Barcelona, and I'd got stuck in San Francisco. When I made it to San Francisco, it was supposed to be for a weekend, stayed for a week, and turned into 2 years. And then I had to, like, rip myself out of San Francisco because I was like, wow, I'll stay here forever without ever actually seeing the world. And if San Francisco is so different from my own country, well, what are other countries like? But I always had a soft spot for San Francisco. When I got to Barcelona, it really felt like San Francisco. It was young, it was creative, there was money. So people had money for the arts, and they were putting money into the arts. If there was a party, there were performances and art. It wasn't just, you know, how much booze could you buy for the party. It was what experience could you create for the people who are the revelers, you know? And that was the same vibe in Barcelona. So I, again, stayed for a week, for a month, for the summer, and that turned into 9 years. And I probably would have stayed there forever. I ended up opening, this is a whole other story, but I ended up opening a circus shop because I was performing on the street as a fire dancer for most of my time in Barcelona. And I ended up selling in markets and opening in markets and teaching people fire dancing and different juggling and other circus schools, circus skills. And so I was really happy. And of course, I had an amazing lighting rig in my circus shop. And so we would do cabarets in my shop. And I could still enjoy my love of lighting. And yeah, so all set up. I've got a huge, beautiful friend network, a nice relationship. My job is great. The shop is doing really well. Our apartment was behind the shop, like golden. The first walk around the city with my newborn daughter brought me back to the shop saying like, okay, let's go. Because my wife had never really liked Barcelona. She was a small town girl as well, but hadn't really, you know, created that network and opportunities for herself like I had yet. And so she was really against Barcelona and wanted to move when we had the baby. And I was like, no way. There's no way. There's too much that we have that it's good here for raising a child. I'm going to teach them trapeze from like 6 months. So like, I'm sorry, we have to stay here. They'll be fire dancing by four. And and she was not into that, but like, okay. And then I went on that first walk around the city, and every siren, every yell, every smell, like I could just see her eyes just get huge, and I could tell it, and her body get rigid within the fabric that was against me, and I could tell that, wait, this is not so great. Oh, I'm gonna ground her. I'm gonna put her on the ground somewhere. So I went to the park and I looked around the park where I'd spent hours and hours and hours and hours with my friends and having beautiful memories and beautiful times and practicing circus things. And looking at the ground, I was like, well, I don't want to put a baby. I think that's spit. Oh, and I don't know what that is. And that's a cigarette butt for sure. And like, ugh. Oh, I'll go to the beach. And I went to the beach. And the beach in Barcelona, again, beautiful memories, amazing, but as well, and anytime you scoop up some sand in Barcelona, you know, Lord knows what you're going to find in your hand. And so I didn't put her down at the beach either. And I was like, wow, I can't find 50 square centimeters to put a baby on the earth anywhere in this city. So I came home and I was like, okay, let's go. And that was it. And then there was a bit of a search to find a place that was funky and cool. I had lived in Washington, D.C., San Francisco, Chiang Mai, Koh Phangan, Thailand, or I'm sorry, Delhi, and London were my list of, and then Barcelona, of course. And like, where am I going to go where I don't feel like a complete freak and that I have some sort of artistic expression and some sort of artistic nutrient to survive? And it took us a while to find a place, and we went around, and usually the more nature you have, the less culture you have. And that's sort of a balance. It seemed, I didn't really think about that before, but it was really hard to find a place that was clean air, clean water, clean earth, where you can put a baby on the ground and not care what they're putting in their mouth. But there's also funky things, and there's workshops and ecstatic dance and whatever else you might want, you know, performances, anything stimulating, creative. And then Ibiza kind of has that. Ibiza has this collection of people who are really interested in creativity and arts. And yet at the same time, my kids have eaten loads of sand here. And I felt pretty good about it. So we kind of found it here. It took us maybe 4 months. Yeah, Milu was 6 months when we moved here. So it took us a while to figure it out. But then yeah, I'm really, really happy with it. Milu is now 14. And I'm really, really happy with her childhood here. And if you ask her as well, she's like, oh no, I love growing up here. Versus growing up in Holland or the States, you know, that kind of options. Or even in the city of Barcelona.
What were you doing in Delhi?
Really just sort of like, honestly, that was just sort of a base to explore India a bit. And I didn't do as much exploration as I wanted to. My grandmother fell ill, and I had to go back to the States earlier because we were having like the last family outing to the beach, which is the thing that I did as a kid. So it was a bit cut short, but sort of that experience of, and Varanasi as well, like taking classes there. I took Ayurvedic massage classes in Varanasi. So Delhi was kind of my base to sort of like explore India, but then yeah, it was cut short.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I don't know, just my experience of the north of India, particularly Varanasi, actually, just intense and
so
different
intense.
And mental.
So intense. So I remember when I first got to Varanasi, actually, that I was standing in an intersection, and if there had been lanes, I'm sure it would have been about 8 lanes going 4 different ways. And I remember standing in the exact middle, crossing the street, and looking around, and in this murky, murky, red, cloudy environment, and cars as far as you can see, cows as far as you can see, everything's making noise, loud, mooing and honking and yelling. as far as the eye can see in any direction. And it was like, what, 47 degrees or something. And I was like, oh, this is it. This is the literal hell. Like, if I were to believe in like an actual hell, I bet this is it. Like, I bet this is it. Like, the feeling that you're burning and it's just overwhelming and you can't breathe because of the smog, because every pipe that's coming out of every one of these cars is spewing this horrible black thing that you know isn't under a lot of regulations. And there's literally thousands of cars in any direction. I was like, yeah, this is it. I've experienced the actual hell.
I mean, you wouldn't put your baby down there.
No.
I just remember once walking through the streets of Varanasi, and I was not very well at all. Yeah. And I was weak and I was skinny and I was just feeling terrible. And I was pretty low, to be fair. And then suddenly galloping around the corner came a load of like what looked like water buffalo, these really big muscly, ones, yeah. Enormous kind of huge cow type things.
Yeah.
And without even like blinking, one of them just slammed into me, knocked me to the floor. Oh. And I lay there just like winded. And then a group of people gathered around and started pointing at me and laughing. And I couldn't even breathe. And I was just lying on the floor with these people laughing at me. And I was like, I just want to die.
So many different kinds of hell available to you in Varanasi.
I mean, it had some serious highlights, but that was definitely the low light for me.
Yeah.
I hear you on the hell factor. I mean, right. Some bad things happened to me when I was there, but that just brought up that memory because it was like, oh, wow. Yeah, I mean, can you imagine that happening anywhere else in the world? People just like using the streets as a toilet, basically, just defecating everywhere. And I was just, every time I came around the corner, there was a man with his pants around his ankles. It was just so strange.
I remember when I first got to India as well, because there's also all of that that's happening. Like the man with his pants around his ankles, he probably has no like qualms about that at all, that you see him, like, right? Yeah. And I remember like first getting to India that, because I'm the tallest thing that has, I think, ever been in India.
How tall are you?
I'm 198, 6'6". And I actually had an accident where I lost 2 centimeters. So I was actually an even 2 meters. But I had a spinal injury, and so I lost 2 centimeters. And it was funny because like all my friends were super, because I had to stay in bed for 6 months. Like, it was a pretty big time in my life. That was also the time that Donald Trump got elected. So
that'll take 2 meters of a man.
Right? And I remember a lot of people being super sympathetic until I got the losing 2 centimeters part of the story. And then there's usually like a bit of a giggle and like, well, come on. I mean, because I tower above most people.
Do you like that?
I never have, actually. I never have, because my big thing is that I want people to feel... to feel open and safe. I like that. And I think that's sort of an element. I think you asked me when we first talked about maybe doing the podcast, you know, like how does that thread together? And I think there's sort of this thing of, with the intimacy coaching, I want people to feel safe about their own sexuality, about their own relationships, and definitely with me, so that they can open up about the other things. And then as well with lighting, it's like, I like to create that sort of environment where it feels magical and safe and warm and inviting. That kind of thing. Where did that come from?
Do you like being tall?
Do I like being tall? So I never really liked it because it felt intimidating often. So I did try for the most of my life, like, let's say half of my life, I think I really tried to make myself small, and rolled my shoulders and scrunched down and kind of walk, not even with straight legs kind of thing. I remember in high school, every time I would walk by a mirror, I was like, oh, that looks horrible. And never really took the time to correct it. And then after university, I guess when I started traveling, then I started to kind of take up a bit more of my actual space, which I'm really proud of myself for, actually, to be able to be grounded and stand in that space. So I think, yes, to answer the question easily, yes, I do like that, but not really in a way that I think I would like, no matter how tall I was. Yeah. Sometimes it's interesting to be the focus of the room and often not.
No, for sure. But I mean, it's, you know, I have been that person that's commented on a person's height in the past. Yeah. I mean, there was an amazing man who came on the podcast, Peter Loredan.
Okay.
And I must admit, I did make a few tall jokes. And then he made a comment once and I could just see that it was like deeply inappropriate, the words that I had chosen. And I was like, man's got a point, actually. I don't know. Like, it's just a natural thing, probably as a British person. In some ways, that's kind of like maybe our sense of humor. But then at the same time, you know, would I like it if he came up to me and told me that I'd gained 10 pounds and made a real big thing about, you know, someone's appearance, I think is a very... We shouldn't really comment on other people's appearances on a frequent basis. I don't think it's that helpful or necessary.
I think it's interesting, right? Because there's that thing of like because of course we're visual creatures, you know, like those of us who are lucky to have sight, like we get 90-something% of our information from visuals. So to make a comment on it, I think is very natural. But that it's from an authentic place and not just sort of a self-internal observation that's made loud, you know, like if with your hair, you have beautiful hair, and so like I could comment like your hair is beautiful, or I could be like, wow, you have long hair, and then make jokes about how long your hair is. It's like, that would be weird, right? But to be like,
for sure,
but to be like, oh, it's really cool, your hair, like that, I really like how, you know, like it's very thick and nice color, like that's a different thing. So if you're commenting on somebody's height, to be like, wow, I really like how tall you are, that's cool, you know, that would be an amazing comment. But it's true, so many times the like, how's the weather up there, it's like a literal thing, like you actually get people saying that all the time. it can be tiresome.
No, I do have a very, very, very tall friend. I don't know exactly how tall he is, but I'd say he's definitely the same height as you, or round about there. And I, you know, I've done that with him as well after a few drinks. Like, you know, it's just one of those things that I don't know. It's like, I don't know. It's irresistible for me somehow.
Yeah.
But it's not because I, you know, I do actually like the fact that he's really tall. I find it quite fascinating, actually, like to be in the presence of someone so dominating in a room in some ways, and he is quite a dominating character, so it's an interesting thing. But I, you know, it's not a derogatory thing. I would never like joke about somebody's height in a nasty way, but I guess just the fact that you merely brought it up in the first place, perhaps for some people, just isn't particularly what they want you to mention, perhaps.
That, like I said, like we're very visual, so it makes perfect sense. But as well, it's kind of the most interesting conversations are like way past the physical and way past, you know, like to get into the idea world. But to completely understand you and where you're coming from, I have to admit that the first thing I do when I see somebody's taller than me is I'm like, wow, you're tall. And then my whole, all of my inner voices are like, what the? But... because it just flies out, doesn't it?
It does, before you know what's actually come out of your face. And Buzz, is that your real name, Buzz?
My real name is, are you ready? Lawrence William Lambert Jr. is my actual legal name.
Very catchy.
Yeah, thanks. The law firm of. And so my parents had, my dad wanted me to be a junior, so that was done. But my mom wasn't terribly convinced. And the next door neighbor, I don't remember this. I was 6 months old. But the next door neighbor came over, apparently, and said that I was the buzzy baby because I could crawl so fast that she was amazed at how fast I could make it across the room. And so she called me the buzzy baby. And apparently I would giggle and laugh every time I was the buzzy baby. And so my parents started calling me Buzzy. Buzzy, time for bed. And I would laugh and laugh and laugh. So then they just kept calling me Buzzy. And around the time in the States when I got my driver's license, then I was just cooler then I was like, I'm just Buzz now. And it's kind of stuck since then.
I thought it was maybe something to do with the lighting.
Yeah, right? No. And it certainly wasn't with any idea of that I'm going to move to Spain someday where everybody will call me Booth. So definitely didn't take that into account.
What does Booth mean?
Booth, that's what everybody here in Spain calls me, because there is no Z in Spanish. So if they see my name written, it's like, oh, Booth. And I'm like, yeah, no. And I say Buzz, and they're like, blah, 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 what? And actually, there was a time at Leo that we had a flamenco night, and we had this like super gypsy gitano, super... family came in, you know, it's just like four performers, but there were 23 people who came to the rehearsal, with all nursing babies and with their dogs, and like it was this real like gitano moment. And at the end of the rehearsal, which went 4 hours overtime, the lead, the matriarch, you know, the lead singer, she came up and she said to the sound guy, "Tú, ¿cómo te llamas?" And he was like, "Manu." And she's like, "Manu, gracias, Manu. ¿Y tú, cómo te llamas?" Buzz. Pachi, gracias, Pachi. It was out of nowhere. I was like, and for the next 3 years of my experience of Leo, I was Pachi. the sound guy lost it, because the sound guy heard people try and say my name for years, you know. And but that took the cake. And that
so this is your new name for the summer,
no.
Patchy.
No.
Should we instigate that?
No.
No. I'll come to the Garden of Light especially just Patchy. To let people know what your real name is.
Yeah.
Brilliant. So let's talk about the intimacy coaching and the tantra. And I mean, you know, I obviously met you actually through a mutual friend of ours, Eliane, who I'm also going to get on this podcast one of these days. But yeah, where did that all begin for you, your kind of fascination with sexuality?
Oh, wow. Okay. I bet it started way earlier than I even think it actually did or was aware of it. My tragic story, my parents separated when I was 7. And, you know, little by little, there's some perception as a child, but then little by little, I started to learn more, mostly from the negative reactions of my mother. Kind of like the source of their separation was my dad's very exuberant, unbridled sexuality and the ethics that were kind of around that and the impact that it had on my mother directly, but then on my family and my upbringing and how my childhood was. You know, went from this nice big house and then moved to a really tiny sort of like kind of ghetto neighborhood, and the implications that had on my life, and sort of piecing things together. And then as well as I was growing up into puberty, having a really strong sexuality and really having an interest in sexuality and kind of talking about that with friends, and my friends would be like, yeah, everybody likes sex buzz. And I'm like, no, there's something different. Like, there's something deeper. Like, I don't want to just have sex. Like, I want to know everything about it. I want to know what this is. And then having a lot of resistance from my mother, for example, to anything sexual, and really seeing kind of that, what that had done to her, and feeling my own experience with the dangers of sexuality, with the incredible power sexuality has to harm and destroy and break down intimacy. When later on discovering that it actually as well is an incredible tool for building intimacy, an incredible tool for healing. But that journey was really after me coming to terms with that, wait, sexuality doesn't have to be this negative connotation that it has had my whole childhood, and kind of discovering that slowly instead of enjoying sexuality, reading about sexuality, having sexual experiences and feeling like dirty about it and feeling like naughty and kind of that I'm doing something that my mother wouldn't approve of, no matter what it was. If it was reading a book about sexuality, even if it was this sort of, you know, medical kind of things or scientific studies or anything like that, even that with this real strong feeling in my whole body that this was wrong. And then slowly kind of opening the doors of tantra and sacred sexuality and somatic healing. There's lots of different sort of subcategories within all of that. And like being like, oh, wait a minute. Like, this might have been fed to me in a very tainted experience of other people who have had very different experiences than from what I'm discovering. Yeah. And that awareness was very beautiful for me and very transformative and very healing bit by bit. The first couple of experiences I had with tantra were in San Francisco. And the first one was so just sort of like over the top, orgiastic, kind of like, this is tantra. And I was like, holy. Like, it was a bit too much for me. Like, I don't want to judge it because I probably had a lot of still of my own internal judgment, you know, from that programming. But I do notice that now I'm also not into that sort of like, wow, over the top. And there was even alcohol involved. Like, it was a bit, there are things now that I can kind of see where I was like, yeah, I get where I had a reaction to it. And so expressing that, I had a friend who brought me to the next tantric thing, which was the, kind of the other side of the coin. And it was so airy-fairy and so up in the air and so full of love and joy and bliss and just pure abject soul pleasure. And I was like, what? And there was no grounding there at all. It was really out of body as well. It was very air and very soul experience. And I was like, I don't know if this is it either. And then I, in San Francisco, everybody is bisexual, everybody's in a polyamorous relationship, everybody's a massage therapist. And I was like, how, what, you can be a massage therapist, you know, like small town boy. And I was like, okay, wait, this is sort of, I think this is where I need to go, because I like the physicality of that crazy orgy that I went to. Like, yeah, touch is beautiful and amazing and creates wonderful feelings in my body. Like, wow, to touch, to give pleasure and to receive is like awesome. But not in that way. And then the other side of like, yeah, spiritual awareness and really feeling bliss and pleasure and this whole feeling of in the now, epic as well. But shouldn't it be a little bit more grounded? So I was like, wait, massage therapy. If that's actually a thing you can study, which I didn't believe until that point, then maybe that's the, you know, sacred touch and grounding touch and really conscious touch. So I'm going to do that. And through that massage course, which was a year and a half of full-on study and full-on study of what it is like to touch someone, what it is like to be touched, and different ways that you can touch somebody. Betty Martin's Wheel of Consent as well is also like a huge part of my life. Just in the different ways that you can touch, you can either give touch, or you can be. I guess the famous example is that you can give or take. For example, the guy in a nightclub that comes up to you and says, "Hey, babe, you want a massage?" He's offering you a gift, right? Like he's willing to sacrifice himself to give you, you know, completely out of the love of his heart and sacrificed by giving you a massage. Or is he? Like, he's really, even though he's giving you something, he's actually taking. So sort of that concept of like and how broad that range can be was really eye-opening for me. And then from that massage course, people who are in that massage course also were taking that massage course because they have been involved in Tantra and other different sort of sex positive type of ways of study as well in San Francisco. And that opened my eyes once I had that basic study of like, no wait, touch can be good, and it doesn't have to be this dark sexuality. It could even be sensual, it could even be sexual, but still be therapeutic. And that was mind-blowing to me. That was really like, whoa, that was that whole shift of like, wait, sexuality is actually epic and beautiful and can be very healing and can be a tool for beautiful intimacy, and it doesn't have to be this dark, you know, thing that you're walking a tightrope of, that you could be, that it can be damaging to an individual or their family or their relationship, or, but that can actually be this like thread that actually holds things together in a beautiful way.
Interesting. I hadn't really heard it from that perspective before. I think my experience, or the only experience that I, or when it first came into my world, was when I was in India again. Mm. And I did the Contact Dance Festival.
Cool.
Which was, you know, interesting. It was like, I don't know, maybe 30 different nationalities from around the world, and quite a lot of Indian people, and from, you know, the locality of Goa. And
cool,
there were some very interesting dynamics going on there, and you spend a whole week contact dancing with such a wide, it was like about 200 people.
Wow.
And it was just actually insane. And then my kind of interest got piqued about the kind of, you know, the more touch side of things. And then, you know, I kind of wanted to explore Tantra, yeah, a little bit. But actually, yeah, it just wasn't for me over there, for sure not. And I haven't gone back down that road since, because I found it a bit like you described, like the really just taking things a little bit too far kind of road in Arambol, and you know, the love temple sessions and the workshops, and yeah, just found the whole thing a bit creepy and weird, and just wasn't my cup of tea, and put me off for life. And I know that there's a, you know, there's a festival here every year, and I've never been, and I've always wanted to go there and just like make a podcast. I'm not sure if I'd literally want to partake per se, but I think to have the experience and report on it would be really fun and interesting, and maybe, just maybe, my mind would get blown along the way.
So I've been involved in that, in the International Tantra Festival run by Santoshi for the last 4 years, 5 years. I did lighting for them for the first 3 years, and then the year before last, I did lighting and massage. And now this last year, I just focused on massage because I really prefer that. And there's also quite a really good lighting team now. And so that was good that I could hand off that mantle to people who I really trusted as well. And I highly recommend it, because in Tantra, I find it difficult to really recommend people, because I have had beautiful moments of learning and deepening my studies and explorations with people that are that I might not be able to suggest to everybody, because maybe they are a little bit too sexual, or maybe a little bit. So it's kind of, it's really difficult to really suggest, oh, you should go to this retreat with this tantra teacher. Because sometimes it'll be too little for someone or too much for someone, or they might shift between that during the retreat. And so I find that responsibility of really recommending somebody quite difficult, although I've had amazing experiences with any teacher that I've studied with very few exceptions. However, the Tantra Festival is a collection of 20 or more teachers that are completely different vibes from each other. Some of them are super sexual, and some of them are super airy-fairy, and most of them are sort of this beautiful balance in between. And then it also depends on what they're teaching. But what a festival does, I haven't been to loads of specifically Tantra Festival. I go to every Tantra workshop at every festival I've been at. But a Tantra Festival has a presentation in the morning, and you get to see all of the people who are teaching, especially at this festival. I love how they do it. You always have a morning group meeting where you meet up in your little group and you talk about what's going on for you first. So that's the base. How are you? What's going on for you? And you do that in your little group. And then you get a presentation from all of these different teachers of what will be being taught that day in the morning session and in the afternoon session. So you have 20 people telling you what they're going to be talking about exactly, what the class is going to entail, and you get to feel their vibe. Like, they might be talking about something that's super interesting to me, but I can't deal with that vibe today, you know, like, and so I will go to the other one and have an amazing experience because, oh wait, that vibe, I've never even thought to talk about that in a tantric way, but their vibe was really cool, so I'm gonna go check that out. For example, this last session episode of the this last edition of the festival, there was a teacher who is Israeli-Palestinian, and he presented himself in the morning, and I already had decided from reading the brochure that, oh, I'm definitely going to go to this other workshop. But his presentation was, he was like, well, I am Israeli-Palestinian, and remember that this is October 26th, the festival, so just mere days after the whole beginning of this, or debatable beginning, but the escalation. And I am also gender fluid, and so I will be talking about the in-between stage and incorporating our whole true selves between masculine and feminine and whatever other identities you hold. Wow. Like, just to think, like, if anybody is going to be able to teach me how to balance between masculine and feminine better than a man who identifies as Israeli-Palestinian, I can't imagine who it would be. And I went to his workshop, and it was epic. Really, really, like, redefining sort of lots of ways that I even teach my own workshops on masculine and femininity. It was amazing. For example, so at a festival, you have that opportunity to really see what you want to learn and what really calls you the most. I couldn't recommend it more. If you're interested at all in Tantra, to go to a festival, because then there's no pressure whatsoever that might be if you're at a retreat, or even if you're at a 3-hour workshop, maybe there's only 10 people at that workshop. So you might feel, depending on how great and centered and all the work you've done, you might feel pressured to do something that you're not 100% comfortable with. And not that that is usually the case, you know, usually there's a huge, huge emphasis on consent and boundaries in Tantra. There should be. If there is not, then run. Get out of that class right away. If they don't talk about boundaries at all, then bail.
That was Aaron Bull.
Yeah, there you go. No.
It was terrifying.
Unfortunately, that can happen a lot because, as we've talked about before, sexuality is this amazing, powerful tool, and a lot of times it can be either wielded with mal intent, or it can be unintentionally wielded in an unresponsible way. So if the facilitator isn't immediately first thing talking about boundaries and consent, then and that none of this workshop is obligatory in any way whatsoever, then that's already kind of a red flag. Like, try and trip out of that. And if they start to talk about, like, let go of your fears, then fucking run. That's tantric tip number one.
What's tantric tip number two?
Yeah, tantric tip number two is relax, let go of your fears.
And just open yourself.
it's literally that. Tantric one is, like, sorry, can I do F-bombs?
Do whatever you want.
fucking set your boundaries hard boundaries. At this workshop, no matter what, like, I'm not going to touch anybody. I don't want anybody to touch me. Boom, set that boundary hard. And then from that strong, super powerful, huge no, you have make sure that you are opening up to a yes all the way around that. And usually, if you can set that hard boundary, no matter how far, or if other people judge you, or if you judge yourself for how far out you create that boundary to protect yourself, then everything outside of that boundary is a yes. For you, for your heart, you know, for your, then you can open up to everything out there because you've set yourself a strong, safe boundary. And we don't really do that very often. So hopefully your facilitator is helping you to create that wicked, amazing, strong, castle-esque boundary for yourself so you feel safe to say yes to things that actually might really serve you outside of those boundaries.
Mm-hmm. Not like what?
A thousand different things that could mean different things to different people. If I'm thinking just touch, because that's usually the boundary that's the most obvious, is like, I don't want anybody to touch me in this workshop, even though maybe it's a tantric massage workshop or some sort of, there's intimacy of touching, or you're instructed to sit in yab yam, where the woman sits cross-legged on top of the man facing, so your chakras are aligned and your chests are together. It's a very intimate position, and often that will happen in tantric workshops, sometimes at the beginning level, sometimes more advanced. But let's say you set yourself a very hard, strong boundary of, no, I'm not going to sit in yab yam, that's too intimate for me, and I don't want to touch anybody, I don't want to be touched. Set that strong boundary, but then within that exercise, maybe there's a lot of eye contact in that exercise, and maybe that's really difficult for you to really keep eye contact with you, with someone. And maybe while you're sitting there away from this person, not in yab yam, in their eyes, maybe something comes up for you that's terrifying, and actually tears come up, and maybe even sobbing and something really strong might come up for you during that eye contact. To make sure that you don't shut that out, because you are safe, because you've set your boundary. Nobody's going to touch you. You've created that boundary. You knew what you needed, and you created that. So now within that safety, let's see what comes up for you. And to not say no to those emotions and feelings that are coming up, but to go ahead and let them have free rein and let them come out, because you know that everyone in that workshop is going to respect your boundaries, especially yourself. That would be an example, for example. But it could be talking about something, it could be expressing something, it could be talking about your past. You can kind of have any sort of boundary, but a true, really good facilitator will help you to work on where your boundaries are, and to help, because it's a difficult thing to begin with. And where do you set that? Most tantra teeth, and of course the festival, like there's always, you know, Tantra 101 is you should go to this boundary workshop. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of, there's this one exercise of finding your no, where people come up to you, the random strangers will come up to you and they'll ask you things, and they'll be like, hey, can I pick your nose? And you might be surprised that people are like, I get, you're like, no, dude, we're in a workshop even, like, I'm down on the street, like, can I stab your hand with a pocket knife? And well, no. And because it's really hard, and honestly, I don't want to say this because of any kind of like intrinsic thing about women, but I think society has taught women to be passive and submissive, and it's often difficult for women to have this easy, strong ability to say no. If they've done their work and they've lived in a cool place like Ibiza and they've done some tantra workshops and they're like, no, awesome, you have amazing, beautiful, or, you know, CEOs in New York City, like, you know, you have incredibly amazing, grounded, powerful women everywhere, and there's still a lot of cleanup to do from, you know, thousands of years of patriarchy and kind of suppressing women. And so it's really, really important that everybody has a keen awareness of boundaries. And then as well, on the flip side of that patriarchy, is to teach men to not feel worthless and horrible and unloved if they receive a no. And a big part of that is teaching both genders that a hard no is not a rejection. It's actually that idea of that it's a huge yes outside of that. Mm-hmm. So the bigger the no is, the stronger the yes is for everything outside of that. And that's a beautiful thing to realize. And so that the man, when he's like, hey, can I give you a massage? And the woman's like, no, but you can buy me a coffee. I'd like to have a conversation with you. And watch that guy freak out and be like, what? And then, like, out of nowhere, some, like, vulnerable, slow intimacy could actually come from that crazy, weird, artificial reaction of trying to get something from somebody. It's like, oh, wait, connection can happen thanks to this epic, beautiful, strong no.
Interesting. I hadn't, thought about it again from that perspective before. And I think, you know, you can take that into all areas of your life, can't you? Not just tantra. Once you've got that in place in the bedroom and in intimate situations, and I'm sure that kind of applies to most things, which is quite a beautiful metaphor, I think, for life in general. It's also brought another memory up for me at the Contact Dance Festival. I remember there was like 200 people and there was this one really, really, really hot guy who I was like completely in love with. Obviously, I had never actually spoken to the man. Oh, wow. It's an hour already, Buzz. How did that happen?
I talk a lot about sexuality. I can talk for days. Keep going.
And, we were told like to grab a partner on the very last day. And, of course, finally, this person came up to me and was like, do you want to be my partner? And I was like, oh, my God, I helped my whole...
Score. Fist bump.
Whole body just go into, like, beetroot, English girl, extremely shy mode.
Oh, no way.
Completely. And the exercise was that we had to sit... facing each other on the floor and pretend that we were a glass of water and the other person was an empty glass of water, and we had to pour ourselves into the other glass.
That's really cool.
And when we reached a space that we felt like home on that person's body, then we would look into their eyes and tell them home. That you felt like home. And I was like, you are joking. Like, absolute horror swept over my person. And I was like, okay, if I died right now, that would be just the perfect moment before I have to do this. And I remember the first thing he did was like sort of like just like wave up and down my body several times and then put his head on my boobs and just look into my eyes and tell me he felt like home. And I was like, oh my God, what do I even do? It was just like awful, like for this British prude like me to just like tolerate this like intimate moment of this man gazing into my eyes that I've been fantasizing about for 7 whole days, wondering when he might finally come and dance with me. But I was new. I'd never danced contact before. So obviously it didn't happen until this very last day of the festival. And it was like, I'll never, ever forget it. It was very, very funny, I suppose. And it shows that probably I have got a little bit of work to do in that department.
I would say no, because he picked you. Like, he knew right where to go. Like, he probably saw you the first thing and he was like, oh, I bet she's going to be home.
I doubt it. I mean, let's
be
honest.
I long to lay upon those breasts. Those homey breasts.
Well, I haven't got any boobs for starters, so the man was after some pancakes, clearly.
Amazing.
Well, unfortunately, that brings us... I've got 1,000,000,000 other questions, but unfortunately, it's been a whole hour, Buzz, since we've been sitting here getting burned to death on the Saturnalia. Beautiful player. But you've been a great sport.
Amazing. Thank you. Yeah, it's been... I love to talk about this. Normalization for me is a really big word. I really like to... that more people talk more about intimacy, more people talk more about sexuality. I had my whole childhood with no one talking to me about sexuality, so I could only incur that it was a horrible, horrible thing. So I think the more people are talking about relationships, which are hard, and the problems we have and how we go through them, and how, internally and with our partners or with just random people, with that guy, for example, like, how do you go through that? And the more people talk about those kind of experiences, I think the easier being a human will be. So that sort of normalization and the conversation about it, I find really important. And not just as an individual, but like as a whole human species, and how we relate to each other also reflects how we relate to our environment and the earth, and how we take care of each other also relates to that as well. And so literally, I think having conversations like this one can kind of, you know, grandiosely say that it can end war and stop screwing up other things that we're messing up in our lives.
Thank you, Buzz, for your enlightened words over the last hour. It's been a true joy to meet you again, and I'm sure we won't.
It feels like home.
You look like home right now. Thank you.
Amazing. Thank you so much.